riding down to Chancellorsville on a horse with eyes of blue. Giving up my daily bread, see what I can do. My bayonet is sharpened up, my musket barrel's clean. Now I'm scared to death, but trying to look formidable and mean. I left my home in Charlottesville to join the AOP. Against the will of my old man, most of the family, they don the gray and sing the tune, Merry Dixieland. Now wear the badge of honor lost, traitor on my hand. There are things I do and don't believe. You better bet that I still have some tricks shoved up my sleeve. With a lover's note, a mother's prayer, and a father's curse. And I'm Lincoln's man, for better or for worse. Jackson, he's a man of God, my father said aloud. Speaks of Christ and family, like a wall of stone so proud. Points his saber at the blue, as beer and windows wave, saying let our brothers pluck the speck, and their plank is drawn away. Since Fredericksburg, the men bend down, and Burnside's been replaced. We're at each other's throats all day, blood and time to waste.
That's a song called Lincoln's Man from the from a CD of the same title by Ben Bedford, who is going to be my second guest, or at least I'll be talking with him on the second portion of our program today. He's going to be performing in Fairmount this weekend. And you're listening to Live and Local. It's your connection to local performances. I'm Kevin Kelly. Good afternoon. Our first segment has to do with, well, appropriately enough, given that last night was the first of the presidential debates for this presidential election year, this segment has to do with a play called 44 Plays for 44 Presidents, which is being presented at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, as well as at least 44 other theaters, colleges, and high schools across the country this season. It opens tonight, runs through the 14th at the Krannert Center, and a play that has five different authors on it. It's being directed by Robert Quinlan, who is a guest director for the University of Illinois Theater Department, and we have Bob and also some of his cast here to give us a preview of, well, we say it's a play, but it's also 44 plays. Is that saying the same thing?
That's right. It's 44 completely different plays that range in style as widely as the presidents themselves. So there are plays that are in a musical theater format and vaudeville, silent film, you name it, we'll do it.
and now I'm losing track, but have there been 44 presidents then?
All 44? If we have a new president, it will be our 45th president. That's
okay.
Right.
So I guess we'll see. All right, well, how many of you watched the debates last night?
We had our invited dress rehearsal last night, so we actually had our first preview audience.
And yet two of them managed to...
Some of us watched it this
online.
Morning.
Online.
Oh, this morning.
Recaps.
Online.
YouTube.
Right. Mm-hmm. And who do you think won?
Hard
to say.
I mean, in terms of character and presentation, I thought Rami did pretty well, but I don't necessarily agree with his policies.
That wasn't my question.
I see.
That wasn't my question. We're not going to get into that.
He was caught, though, in a couple of lies that I don't think helped him. So.
But, well. And other people on the win-loss thing?
I think a used car salesman can sell a car really well. And you can say he got the sale.
Okay. Maybe I'm sorry I asked. I was foolishly objecting or expecting maybe we'd get an objective answer to that
question. The play is very, very objective.
Is it actually?
Yes.
It tries to be, yeah. They try to keep the politics out of it as much as possible.
Because Joe Bersma, who actually answered the debate question first, it was interesting that your answer had to do, well, in terms of character and something.
Presentation.
Now, when you say character, did that have to do with character in the sense of a character in a play?
I just thought in terms of his physical presence and his stream of thought. I thought he presented himself very articulately, I think, probably from the practice he's had over the past couple of years and the confidence that he has.
So do we find out during the course of 44 plays for 44 presidents how many of our presidents had a character of their own?
Well, the play is a kind of investigation about what kind of person makes a great president. And they start with the idea that George Washington really was very good and started a lot of the traditions that have become the job that is now the presidency. So they kind of use him as the example by which they judge the rest of the presidents, which is a person who really wants to lead for big ideas as opposed to personal glory.
And maybe since there was no precedent for the president at that point,
right,
what did he have to lose? I mean, it wasn't a job he wanted, supposedly.
Exactly. That's the story.
And ever since, just building on all the reasons not to, well, all kinds of other reasons to be president, and one wonders along the way. You brought along your dramaturg.
Yes.
Who
Seth.
Has some of the,
yes.
the, Seth Valentine, who has some of the history. Did you pursue the history of all the presidents, or did you pursue the history of this play, or what was?
I did some of both. It depended on. Initially, we talked about the production history of the play and the group, the neo-futurists who wrote it, and their style.
Okay, what is that?
The neo-futurists are a Chicago-based theater group who are famous for a play called "Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind," where they do 30 plays in 60 minutes. So their whole style is based on doing a lot of plays really quickly. They draw a lot of influences from European modernist theater, Dadaism and Surrealism, but most particularly a style of theater called epic theater that was practiced by a guy in Germany named Bertolt Brecht. And the idea is that you're not really playing the character, you're yourself presenting this character. And so their whole aesthetic is based on the actors driving the show, more than trying to convince the audience realistically that they are a character. So it's not really a series of impressions of the presidents. It's more, it's able to explore and investigate what their presidencies were about and what the history of the country is and the history of the office.
They really are interested in having the audience constantly aware that they're watching a play. You're not supposed to lose yourself in it in any way. You're supposed to be thinking critically about it and aware of the artifice of the theater itself.
But you do have people playing the presidents.
Yes.
Yes. There's a convention in the play that there's a patriotic-looking coat that flies in from the grid at the beginning of the play, and the actor, who is Wigazi, puts it on, and then he is George Washington for that first play, and then a bunch of other people fight over it, and every play somebody else gets it, and the actor who gets the coat plays the president.
And this is Preston Wigazi Brandt.
Yes.
Who gets to be George Washington. So does that put a lot on you?
I think George, me personally?
Yeah.
No. Because I'm having a lot of fun doing it as myself and presenting the presidency in the form that we just discussed.
Because he actually plays George Washington and Barack Obama.
Yes. The first and the last.
And
that's
FDR,
actually more fun.
And FDR and Ward Harding.
Yeah, so all these folks are playing at least four or five different presidents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I know we have some samples here, some scenes that we're going to sample from, and one complete play?
One complete play. Actually, two of them are complete plays. So they're only about 2 minutes
very short,
long.
Yeah.
So I thought maybe we'd start with Harding.
Sure.
Who is known as one of the worst presidents.
I was going to say that.
I should say that there's a convention in the play also where there is a light that goes off and a little ding every time there is an actual direct quote from one of the presidents. So we will hear that in this play. So keep that in mind as you're listening, that when you hear a ding, it's something that Warren Harding actually said.
And also in this scene, there's a reference to an earlier scene where William Howard Taft is played by me, and I'm wearing an enormous fat suit and have a baby bonnet on my head and have been being fed applesauce and I'm screaming and yelling and keep complaining that I want to be a Supreme Court Justice of the United States and not the president. And so I make it a re-entrance in this scene, and that's the part that
there's a cameo of a baby.
Yes.
That almost sounds like a scene from Monty Python's The History of the
that
World.
That would certainly be appropriate, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Great. Let's go ahead.
Warren, so does each of these segments, is it called That President,
no,
or is
they
not?
Have different titles.
This one is called Facts, Opinions, and Superlatives, Oh My.
But having to do with Warren G. Harding.
Yes.
One of the United States' worst presidents.
Number 29,
thank you.
Very common opinion. Warren G. Harding was the worst president in American history.
It is the patriot's duty to safeguard America first. To think of America first. To stabilize America first. To prosper America first, to exalt America first, to live for and revere America first. America's need is not revolution, but restoration. Not surgery, but serenity. Not nostrums, but normalcy.
Opinion. Warren G. Harding was a small-town poker-playing, drunken politician who was way out of his league.
Am I man enough for this office?
Fact. Harding won the popular vote by one of the biggest majorities in American history.
We're in the big leagues now, boys. My God, what a hell of a job.
Fact. Harding took office a few years after the First World War ended, while Europe was still struggling to repair the damages.
I don't know anything about this European stuff.
Opinion? Harding's domestic policy reflected a similar cluelessness.
I can't make a damn thing out of this tax problem.
I'm Chief Justice of the Supreme Court! Woo! I don't even remember that I ever was president.
Opinion. Harding's well-connected wife got him elected. His friends, whom he appointed to several offices, propped him up and convinced him that he was the right man for the job. Fact. Those same friends stole money from the government, causing a huge scandal.
I have no trouble with my enemies, but my friends, they're the ones that keep me walking the floor at nights.
Fact, after being caught, two of those friends committed suicide. Opinion, Harding was a self-effacing, lost, betrayed, shallow, confused, and dumbfounded man from 1921 to 1923.
I am a man of limited talents from a small town. I do not seem to grasp that I am president. I am not fit for this office and should have never been in it.
Fact. Harding died in his sleep, probably from a blood clot, while taking a vacation to Alaska to relieve his stress. Opinion? His immediate legacy was a series of hearings, further scandals, arrests, stories of an illegitimate child and adulterous relationships, as well as a book with an audacious theory that his wife had conspired to murder him. Opinion? President Harding's legacy is the most besmirched, disastrous, and outrageous of all the presidencies in our history.
Nice way to start. Actually, one wonders if it wouldn't be a good idea to have one of those bells at the debates every time somebody
right.
yeah.
says something that isn't true. Yeah. It would be dinging all the time, no matter who's talking, probably. So is this, I guess we'll hear from two other examples, but is this typical of the back and forth, or is this
a little bit? This is a little bit more pure information, I would say, than some of the other plays. But this is the idea that you learn a little bit about each president in some way through each of the 44 plays.
We're talking about 44 plays for 44 presidents that is opening tonight at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, being put on by the University of Illinois Department of Theater. And all of our guests today, with the exception of the director, I guess, are either bachelor's or master's candidates in fine arts in theater, right? Everybody's in theater.
Yes, yep.
Correct.
And so do you, as an assignment, everybody who's playing a president, are you all supposed to research this president or something like that?
It depends on the president and the way it's staged in the show. I mean, we had a dramaturgical talk before we started to block and work out the scene for each one as far as like actual facts, what happened, what they accomplished during their presidency, interesting facts about them. But then the way the play is staged kind of indicates if you want to look more at the characterization of the president. I mean, we're not doing impressions, but some physical work is interesting for certain presidents. Like Gerald Ford, for example, one of the main devices we use is the fact that he was very clumsy. So he fell a lot in real life. So that's something that Wagasi is doing. But it just depends on the president, I think. I don't know if anyone wants to expand.
Yeah, well, and in addition to that, along with the dramaturg that we talked to before staging every scene, we also someone was assigned that president to come in with research that they had done. Mm-hmm. And then we would sit down in a circle, all discuss that president, his foreign policy, his domestic policy, what legislation he passed, what was going on in the world and in the country, and have that conversation with Seth, who's very, very informed, and then start that staging, because you would find a lot of smaller things that might be, you know, tossed out in a script that now you know what it means and how large it can really be.
And also not just about the president, but what was happening at that time mm-hmm. really America. Helped us work out the world of the play and help develop the character more.
Absolutely.
As you get closer to the presidents, the later presidents who are actually have been president during our lifetimes, mm-hmm. and some of us have longer lifetimes than others in this room, did it get easier or harder to analyze?
I actually think it's harder.
Harder.
Mm-hmm.
Harder to stay objective.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It's written very, very, very well with that in mind. And also presidents that you have a bias to because maybe, you know, you were brought up to think that this person was fantastic, but then you also forget, oh, but there was also other aspects of the presidency that maybe didn't go so well. So it's really, I think it's harder to be objective in the presidents that we know because we see them as more human beings as opposed to, like, legacies. And you can approach a legacy kind of objective from the beginning, but people that you've seen as human beings mispronouncing things and, like, tripping and falling and, mm-hmm. you know, and policies that affected you, it's harder to stay objective.
Well, plus history hasn't paid attention to that stuff, mm-hmm. you know, say with Washington. Okay, so we know he may have worn wooden teeth, but other than that, that's about as much dirt as you get on George Washington.
Yeah, we talked about how there's this big gap in American history for students, that you learn about Washington and Jefferson, and then you kind of, I mean, you know other political figures at the time, like Ben Franklin and things that you associate with that early colonial time period, and then it kind of jumps to Lincoln in your brain, and you know Lincoln, and you know, like, some Civil War history, and then, for me at least, and some of the rest of us, it jumped all the way to Teddy Roosevelt, which is like a huge gap of time. I mean, you learn these histories, but you don't associate a lot of it with a president or a figure that you really think of as, oh, and, you know, then you go to Kennedy, and then from Kennedy on, we all were really aware of a lot more, and then obviously the recent presidents, but it's these gaps of history that we just were...
It was interesting to have an audience last night, too.
Yeah.
One of the things that happens in the play is that every time there's a new president, his portrait will come up on a big slide with his signature, and you'll know that that's the next president while we transition into the next play. And there was silence for a long time, and then we started to get applause for certain presidents or boos for certain presidents or laughter for certain presidents. So you actually can hear the preconceptions about these men.
Including all the ones, the non-reaction to the ones whose picture you don't recognize at all.
Yeah. Kind of trying to read the signature and figure out who it is.
Yeah, I went back. I have a high school, a middle school textbook, an American history textbook, and I went back and there were presidents that were not even listed unless, you know, they were all listed at the end of the book, but I was looking for Calvin Coolidge and I was like, he's not even listed in any chapters.
That's somewhat bizarre.
But that might not be a bad segue Calvin Coolidge, which is a song that we are going to sing.
Okay. This is from 44 Plays for 44 Presidents, which opens tonight at the Kranich Center in Urbana.
Silent Cal woke up one late summer night. Then he took the oath in his father's house, and then he went back to sleep. Silent Cal never kept a phone on his desk. Did he do it to save money or just because he didn't talk? And some might say that he watched his world fall apart And some might say he just wanted his government small, but he worked and worked just to keep us in the black. But Silent Cal, he wouldn't say anything back. Silent Cal, he just let things run their course, but those still waters run deep, and we drowned in Silent Cal. And we drowned in Silent Cal. And we drowned. Hey, Cal, I made a bet with Wagazi before the show that I could get you to say three words.
You lose.
From, so what is that one called?
It's called Cal. Silent Cal.
It is called Silent Cal, okay. And is that the whole thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's famous for not saying much.
Oh, all right, fair enough.
Not necessarily. That's a real story that somebody challenged him at a party. A woman told the story about him that she asked him. There was a bet if she could get him to say three words, and that was his response.
He said, "You lose."
Fair enough. And Sidney Germain singing, Tom Miller playing, and which reminds me, I forgot to acknowledge in the earlier play, Wigazi Brandt and Christina Loy and Joe Burisma all in that one. And what's the third?
The third is the part of the play about Abraham Lincoln. And this is where we will have a little bit of an accompaniment from off stage.
Okay.
And so let's go ahead and start from after the canon.
Age 4, Lincoln's brother dies. Age 9, Lincoln's mother dies. 19, Sister Sarah dies. 22, his fiancée dies. 41, his little boy dies. 42, his father dies. 53, another son dies. 56, Mr. Lincoln dies.
Stones River, Shiloh, Antietam, Gettysburg.
In battle, 200,000. Disease, 400,000. In total, 600,000. 2% of America dies.
Age 4, Lincoln's brother dies. Age 9, Lincoln's mother dies. 19, Sister Sarah dies. 22, his fiancée dies. 41, his little boy dies. 42, his father dies. 53, another son dies. 56, Mr. Lincoln dies. Age 4, Lincoln's brother dies. Age 9, Lincoln's mother dies. 19, Sister Sarah dies. 22, his fiancée dies. 41, his little boy dies. 42, his father dies. 53, another son dies. 56, Mr. Lincoln dies. Age 4, Lincoln's brother dies. Age 9, Lincoln's mother dies. 19, Sister Sarah dies. 22, his fiance dies. 41, his little boy dies. 42, his father dies. 53, another son dies. 56, Mr. Lee.
Six Sepulturanus, the South is avenged.
Mm-hmm. The segment about Abraham Lincoln from 44 Plays, 444 Presidents, with members of the cast from the University of Illinois Theater Department production. They were in no particular order, except from my left to my right in this room, Tom Miller, Preston Wigazi Brandt, Christina Loy, Joe Bersma, Sydney Germain, Tanisha Pyron, Seth Valentine, actually is the dramaturg, wasn't participating in that bit, and Cassandra Cushman, and their director is Robert Quinlan, guest of the department. It opens tonight at 7:30 in the Studio Theater at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, continues through Sunday, October the 14th. That one happens to be a matinee. You can get the complete schedule by going to krannertcenter.com. Thanks to everybody for coming in, and best of luck with your opening.
Thank you.
You're listening to Live and Local on FM 90.9. Support for our show today comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wine, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held on Saturdays from 3 to 6:30 p.m. in the Bouvon Wine Bar. More information is available on the Corkscrew's Facebook page. We also have support from Sinfonia da Camera, presenting Lilacs in Bloom on Saturday, October 6th at 7:30 p.m. at Krannert. George Walker joins Sinfonia for a premiere of his work for cello and orchestra and a performance of his Lilacs. Ticket information is available at 333-6280, and Mr. Walker will be one of my guests on tomorrow's Live and Local.
Red-winged blackbird on a split-rail fence I ain't seen since God knows when. Months ago, up in Illinois, along the Sangamon with my wife and boy. And God, I'm only 21. I got a muzzle-loading 58 Springfield gun. But I'd rather push my wooden plow. I'd feel the strain of the ox and a sweat-stained brow. And I'd go back home, but I don't know how. My face is black from the cook fire soot. I got worn out legs and 10 blisters on each foot. My letters might find her, but hers don't find me. They say the post got lost up in Tennessee. And I'm proud to serve, I just feel alone. At least the gray coats ain't so far from home. At night I hear those swampland sounds. The mosquitoes here must weigh 15 pounds. And I'd go back home, but I don't know how. Go back home, but I don't know how. Last night we climbed up to the levee top. We could see the holes in the houses where the balls had dropped. 12-pound, 10-pound, 8-pound shells. There was a symphony of crashes with the town hall bell. It makes my heart stop every time. The iron hits a white frame house like mine. John Pemberton, please surrender now. There's a stale smell over Vicksburg town. And I'd go back home, but I don't know how. On a split rail fence, I ain't seen since God knows when.
That song is called 21 by Ben Bedford. It's the opening track on his previous CD, previous to the one just out, which we'll talk about shortly. It's called Land of the Shadows. Ben Bedford featured as the vocalist and guitarist, and he's got a number of other performers on that CD with him, as well as on the new one. He's going to be at Sleepy Creek Vineyards in Fairmount Saturday night for an 8 o'clock show, and he is with me on the line from Springfield, Illinois. Thanks very much for joining us, Ben.
Thank you, Kevin. It's great to be with you.
I had to ask you, I guess, yesterday, because I had parts of your bio, and I was kind of here reading little bits from here and there, if you were originally from there, still living there, I guess partly because when you hear that somebody has been named by somebody else one of the 50 most significant folk singer-songwriters of the past 50 years, you assume they're not going to be from your neck of the woods.
Sure.
And here
sure.
you are. I actually made reference to that on earlier this week on the show, and that was Rich Warren of WFMT, who actually also lives down here.
Yes, he does.
And produces his show called The Midnight Special, which originates out of WFMT, but we air here on WYLL. In any event, I'm sure that was an exciting thing for you, because a lot of the people who were also on his list were some of your own idols.
Oh, absolutely. Gosh. Yeah, I was blown away when Rich put me on that list, and many of them are my idols for sure, like Bob Dylan, of course, and Gordon Lightfoot, and John Prine, Townes Van Zandt. The list goes on and on.
I guess the other thought before I had seen that mention was just listening to this CD. The songwriting is so assured, the singing so polished, and what are the other words I want? I mean, so extremely professional sounding that I just, I just assumed you'd be from Nashville or one of those big cities. But basically born and raised from around here. What made you stick around?
Yeah.
So far?
That's a good question. Well, I went to high school in Chatham, Illinois, and then went to the University of Illinois there in Urbana-Champaign, and came back to Springfield. Chatham's just south of Springfield, and I met my now wife, Carrie, and I guess that's part of it. I don't know. I like Central Illinois and the Midwest, and it feels like home to me. So there was a time when I thought about moving to Nashville, or I thought maybe I had to move to Nashville, but I think otherwise now. Not that there's anything wrong with Nashville. Nashville's a great town, but I like it here.
But everybody else is there, so why not
be
here, right? Well,
yeah.
and you put the Midwest, you put Springfield, you put this whole area in your songs, as well as putting your interest in history. You went to the U of I and majored in history, and the song that we opened with from called 21, although it doesn't directly say so, I assume this is a Civil War song.
It is, yep. Yeah, it takes place around the Battle of Vicksburg, or the march south towards Vicksburg, anyway. And, of course, you know, Civil War history with the land of Lincoln and all looms large in Springfield for sure. That's sort of the jumping off point, I think, for a lot of my songs is some sort of story, historically speaking, some sort of story, but hopefully, you know, it becomes a human thing and not just a history thing in the process.
Elaborate on that a little bit.
Well, I mean, a lot of people, you know, talk about my songs being sort of historical in nature, and they certainly are. But I don't really think about them as historical when I'm writing them. I think of them more just simply as stories from an individual's perspective or whatever. So hopefully they appeal to somebody who is interested in history specifically, but hopefully they also appeal to somebody who's just sort of interested in the human condition in general.
In the notes to your new record, which is just out, what, in the last month or so?
Yeah, actually, the official release date was Monday.
Oh, wow. So we really caught this very quickly then.
Perfectly, yeah.
It's called What We Lost on Waterbug Records. And the notes that I read anyway online say that you were inspired somewhat, or at least learned some lessons from writers, John Steinbeck and Toni Morrison, you mentioned specifically. And
yep.
I wonder what's their influence on you generally, or specifically on this new record, which we'll sample from coming up in a minute here.
Sure. I spend a lot of time just reading, probably as much or possibly more time than I do even listening to music. And I feel like I'm influenced in large part just from simple prose. Prose writing in general. I don't know, Toni Morrison and John Steinbeck are two writers who especially appeal to me. You know, both obviously extremely good writers. Toni Morrison especially has sort of a, I don't know exactly how to articulate it, but like a very straightforward, elegant writing style that, I don't know, you know, I'd like to try to emulate in some way and maybe translate that influence into my writing of songs, you know.
Straightforward, but also, I thought, very poetic.
Very poetic, yes, definitely. There's a sort of just really lean poetry to her writing that I really like.
And her writing, you can't necessarily see straight through it. I mean, the stories seem to be, I mean, at least I had the sense, the ones that I've read, that you think you know what they're about, but you're never exactly sure.
Right, yeah.
And definitely. I would say that about your songs that I've been able to hear so far, where, for example, I want to play the opening song from the new record, What We Lost, is called John the Baptist. And that's from reading that title, you would assume, well, I know what this is going to be about. And then I listened to it twice. And I thought, I'm not sure I know what that's about.
Uh-huh.
So talk about that song maybe as an example of Ben Bedford's songwriting.
Sure. Okay. Well, that song specifically, I think, is a good example of sort of my portrait style of writing, I guess you could call it, and maybe take a historical figure like John the Baptist or whomever, and I just sort of try to sketch out maybe their something about them or whatever, and you know, I guess try to shed light on the person without being too biased in any direction, I guess, maybe. And hopefully there's a sort of straightforward element to the writing, you know, but it's also hopefully complex enough that you keep coming back to it and like you said, maybe thinking that you're not quite getting what I'm saying. Hopefully there's some holes that I'm leaving there.
Well, I you know, as I was listening, I was imagining, well, this could be about the John the Baptist from the Bible, or this could be about somebody else you encountered along the way who had characteristics of some sort or another that you imagined that
Sure.
John the Baptist might have had.
Sure. Yeah, I certainly had sort of, I wasn't thinking of anybody specific that I actually encountered personally, but I definitely had sort of a televangelist idea in the back of my head, maybe.
Okay, well, with that image in mind, and of course we know what happened to John the Baptist.
Yeah, didn't end up so well for him, yeah.
Here's that song by Ben Bedford. It's from the new album called What We Lost. Ben Bedford's going to be at Sleepy Creek Vineyards in Fairmount Saturday night, and he's my guest on Live and Local.
From the sun, his face was flecked with sweat. Red stain on the back of his neck. Howling out beneath the sky. You don't have to be afraid to die. River water's cool and clean. Burnsin' off like gasoline. Never mind your tooth for tooth. Madman truth is still the truth. You've been warned you won't get far. Life's crooked as a scimitar. Cut the cord, there ain't no doubt. It's one way. Foretold with tongues as hot as burnished coal, a harbinger of hair and bone, wailing in the wild alone. Wanna see what's up above? Then pledge your heart to the hanging judge. But don't wait around. Presence just the recent past. You've been warned you won't get far. Life's crooked as a scimitar. Cut the cord, there ain't no doubt. It's one way. Bend. And a broken soul you cannot mend. Not till you raise repentant hands. And a thorn tree in the garden stands. From the sun his face was flecked with sweat. Red stain on the back of his neck. Howling out beneath the sky. You don't have to be afraid to die. You don't have to be afraid to die.
Song's called John the Baptist by Ben Bedford. In this CD, he also features a number of other musicians. I'm not sure how many of them are on this particular song, but Chaz Williams is on electric guitars, his wife Carrie Bedford on the harmony vocals, Peter Young on drums and percussion, Adam Gardner on bass, Dennis Wage on the Hammond B3, and Ron De La Vega on the cello. And we'll hear all or most of them, I imagine, as we hear a couple more songs as well. Ben Bedford is here with us on Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly, and he'll be in Fairmount for a concert at Sleepy Creek Vineyards Saturday night at 8 o'clock. This is kind of interesting, Ben, because I think it was a week ago today that on this show I talked with another singer-songwriter who's making quite a name for himself, who's also living in this area, but I can't imagine two more diametrically opposed styles of singing and styles of writing, and that's William Fitzsimmons.
Oh, yeah, okay, sure.
He's
living over in Jacksonville, I think. Is
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and in fact, he's going to be, well, now I've forgotten the date, but he's going to be singing in Springfield coming up maybe also this weekend.
Yeah.
And I noted, I read it, somebody did an interview with you a couple years ago, and you were telling that person that you didn't feel you're very good at writing songs that are more introspective, and of course, he's entirely about that. And
sure.
He's got this really sort of closed-in vocal style, and yours is just right out there.
Yeah.
You know, telegraphing these stories about other people. And without that any more from me, maybe talk about, you know, your non-introspection in the songs and how it matches with your vocal delivery.
Okay, sure. Yeah, you know, I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and I mentioned that I was specifically talking about love songs, and of course, love songs being, well, there's a lot of them out there, let's put it that way.
That's for sure.
And I mentioned that I don't think I'm necessarily very good at writing love songs, and love songs are definitely sort of an introspective sort of one kind of introspective, or they can be introspective anyway. And I don't know if it was simply my sort of interest in history or sort of more objective storytelling or what that has sort of led me down this road of writing songs about other people. But I don't know, maybe I don't feel like writing about my own sort of personal life is all that interesting.
You don't seem to have, as perhaps William does, a lot of demons to be exorcised.
Well, that's possible. Or I don't sing about them anyway.
Well, that's another thing, because when he and I were talking about this, it's, you know, there was the question is whether most singer-songwriters, whether they admit it or not, are really writing from their own personal experience. Is it perhaps in your case that the part of yourself that shows up is people you met, things you've read, and how you respond to them, things you think about them?
Yeah.
Rather certainly. Than how, you know, things that happened to you personally.
Yeah, sure. I find writing about things that have happened to me directly to be really difficult. I don't know. I try in a song, for instance, like "Land of the Shadows," the title track to my last album, which is about the murder of Emmett Till. For me, it's easier to write about subject matter like that because I can kind of stand back from it and say, "This was a horrible thing, and here is what happened." Maybe I'm too close to things that land on top of me or something like that. I don't know.
Are you nonetheless able then, in the case of Emmett Till, to attempt to put yourself into that time and that event and maybe experience outrage on their behalf and put that into the song?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And I'm definitely one of those people that like throws stuff at the television screen during movies and stuff like that, because my suspension of disbelief is so powerful that I literally feel rage boil up inside of me at injustice on the television screen, you know, that kind of thing. So, yeah, definitely.
The title track from What We Lost, again, listening to this song a couple of times, it sounds like, this one at least sounds to me like less attached to a particular event or person than maybe some of the other songs, or am I missing something?
No, that's a astute observation. It doesn't take place around a specific event like a single day sort of event, but it takes place in the years, I guess. The song was actually written from my grandfather's perspective and takes place in sort of the years after the Second World War. And he lost his youngest brother, Ray, in the Second World War in 1944. And so the song is written from his perspective, sort of looking at these photographs of his brother and remembering the good old days, I guess you could say.
Let's give it a listen. It's called What We Lost, Ben Bedford's song. He's going to be at Sleepy Creek Vineyards in Fairmount Saturday night at 8 o'clock. He's my guest on Live and Local here on FM 90.9.
Well, I'm going back to find something that I left behind. And this fading photograph, folded one too many times, we didn't know that we were poor, running, laughing out the door. I hear the corn was 8 feet high in the fall of 44. And if I see you in the summer, this whole damn thing is done. Maybe we will not remember what we lost and what we won. We were smiling like we felt, and no tongue could ever tell. And you smoked that cigarette like the world could go to hell. An army issue green, in the damp Midwestern heat, in the midday light of June. Busting at the seams. If I see you in the summer, this whole damn thing is done. Maybe we will not remember what we lost and what we won. That I could say what I can never say. My brother and my friend, too young to fade away. If I see you in the summer, this whole damn thing is done. Maybe we will not remember
we lost and what we won. I'm going back to find something that I left behind. In this fading photograph, folded one too many times,
that song is What We Lost. It's also the name of the new album. The new CD by Ben Bedford is officially out just this week on Waterbug Records, and you can find it on their website, you can find it on his website, you can find it on CD Baby, and he is going to be appearing in Fairmount at Sleepy Creek Vineyard Saturday night at 8 o'clock, and he's with us here on Live and Local. Ben, from Chatham, Illinois originally, lives in Springfield, went to the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign, majored in history. A lot of that shows up, I mean, all of that shows up in his songs. But also some other things as well, and I've been sort of torn a little bit what song I want to go out with. I guess just sort of arbitrarily, I'll pick Empty Sky.
Okay.
And it seems to, you make
excellent
reference
choice.
To, thank you very much, well, it's a good song. It makes explicit reference in here to the American Dream. There's reference to sharing an apple in a bad sort of way, as if there's something having to do with Adam and Eve. So what's the background of this one?
It is a retelling of the Adam and Eve expulsion from the garden story, I guess you could say, with the twist being that Adam and Eve find paradise outside of the garden instead of eternal torture, I guess.
And they go on to live the American dream.
Right, exactly. Naturally.
Naturally.
Yeah, it's, I guess, turns the story on its head, I guess you could say.
And that is how we will end here. And people can go hear Ben Bedford at Sleepy Creek Vineyards Saturday night. That's in Fairmount, partway between Champaign-Urbana and Danville. 8 o'clock show. You can find their website easily enough, Sleepy Creek Vineyards, and see about tickets and so on. And you can find Ben Bedford by going to his website, which I think is just benbedford.com, isn't it?
That's it.
And thank you very much for joining us on Live and Local.
Thank you, Kevin. It was a pleasure.
She plucked the apple from the tree. She bit into the flesh. She heard no angels cry. How'd it all come down to this? Like a woman, she turned out of the darkness. She went home to her man.
Today's broadcast on Live and Local is made possible by these business partners: AgriGold Hybrids Muhammad, Charles M. Hundley Champagne, Michael Walker Consulting Urbana, and Bates Commodities of Normal. These business partners join the Friends of WYLL in making great programs possible, and we thank you. You're listening to 90.9 WYLL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR, classical music, and more for Central Illinois. We're a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.